We're talking about Facebook striking a deal with the Australian government over paying for news content and what ripple effect this might have in the U.S. and elsewhere. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. So Facebook had removed news from its platform in Australia 1 week ago, meaning it blocked users there from sharing or reading news stories. Facebook has since reversed course, saying it will restore news because it got sufficient concessions from the government. Have you been following the developments between tech giants and the Australian Parliament? What do you think of this media code law legislation? 800-642-1234 to join in. Siva Vaidyanathan is a Robertson Professor of Media Studies and Director of the Center for Media and Citizenship at the University of Virginia. Siva, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. It's actually good to be back. I used to teach at UW many years ago. Welcome home.
Been on the station
a few times. Yeah, the network a few times.
Well, this blackout seemed like a pretty bold move. Can you walk us through what happened and why news stories went dark a week ago?
Yeah, sure. You know, a lot of places around the world have been concerned about the fact that advertising dollars are flowing to Facebook and Google and almost nobody else, right? So now that's particularly true about web dollars, right? So, and that's a larger portion of advertising every year. So if you want to have a public sphere that is full of independent voices, that is full of diverse voices, that is full of, you know, responsible, well-funded journalism, you have to figure out a way to pay for it, as we all know, right? Now, a lot of the countries that are standing up to Facebook and Google about this phenomenon happen to have pretty strong public media systems anyway, but they are concerned that that's not enough. So you've seen in places like Spain a really aggressive enforcement of copyright, so that Google and Facebook have to pay and get permission, have to license news content to flow on its services. Hmm. You've seen similar proposals in other places in Europe, and currently it's part of the debate in Canada. But Australia has taken a particularly interesting move here.
Yeah, Australia, can you explain this news media bargaining code and what it would do?
Right. So what Australia wanted to do was, instead of using copyright and instead of using a tax, like a straight tax on social media advertising or online advertising that would then fund news organizations, the different people, Australia has decided to force the tech platforms and news organizations to the bargaining table. So they work out an arrangement. They work out a set of terms for the ability to have news flow, those established news organizations' content flow on Facebook and Google and Twitter and Instagram and all of the above. And to do that, they basically said, if you don't reach a deal, you know, if The Age, one of Australia's biggest newspapers, doesn't reach a deal with Facebook over distribution, then there will be an arbitration board that will sit down and determine the terms. Now, that means that in order for Facebook to operate in Australia, it would have to comply with those terms if it failed to negotiate the terms, right? So this is what Facebook had a problem with. Facebook doesn't like to be told what it should do. Facebook doesn't like complying with local laws if it doesn't have to, right? And so Google and Facebook took two very different routes or reactions to this proposal.
And I want to get to those different reactions to the proposal in just a minute. I'm going to reintroduce you. We're talking with Siva Vaidyanathan, who's a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia, as we discuss Facebook's battle with regulators in Australia. And then what could this signal around the world with your insights? How did you view Facebook's news blackout on an entire continent, Australia? Do you think it's fair? Are you concerned what this may hold in other parts of the world? 800-642-1234. So, Siva, what did Google do versus, you know, how Facebook reacted with a blackout?
Well, it's important to remember that this proposed law is only proposed.
Right.
This is not the law in Australia yet. This is in anticipation of the law. So they took two different strategies. Google decided, let's placate Australia. Like, let's cut some deals before it's the law, and maybe that will reduce the pressure on Australia, on the Australian legislature, to actually pass a law that would, you know, dictate the terms or maybe get Google into trouble in the future. So Google immediately started negotiating with the major news organizations in Australia so that they could go to Australia and say, hey, look, problem solved. You don't need to act.
Rupert Murdoch, you know, News Corp being one of those.
That's right. And that's sort of the backstory of this. Facebook took a very different approach, which was combative and petulant. Facebook said, we're taking our ball and going home. We are not going to let news flow. Now, it was pretty clear to all the observers that this was going to be a temporary thing. Facebook needs that content more than that content needs Facebook. Last week they just all of a sudden decided news content won't flow in Australia. And I have a lot of friends in Australia, and a lot of them study Facebook. A lot of them are journalists. I was watching their reaction, and their reaction was mostly amusement, right? This notion that Australians don't know how to find news without Facebook was kind of absurd. You know, the fact is we've long had ways of accessing news and information that don't require Facebook. Facebook just got here. You know,
well, observers of this proposed law say that, you know, it's the big players. It's the Rupert Murdochs, the News Corps of the world will be the big winners here, while the small news media startups, the small publishers, small outlets will suffer most. Why is that?
Yeah. I'm not sure that that's true.
OK,
I don't necessarily buy that for a couple of reasons. One, there are so many different ways in a place like Australia for news to be distributed and for audiences to build. And we've seen that time and time again. Now, that the big winners always win, well, that's a fact of life in capitalism, unfortunately. And so, yes, this was in many ways a showdown between Rupert Murdoch and Mark Zuckerberg. You know, who's going to have the will? Who's going to bend? Who's going to get Australia to than to his political will? And of course, Murdoch, being Australian and running most of the major news organizations in Australia, won for the most part. You know, he got the Australian government to take this proposal seriously. It's a proposal that specifically benefits, or particularly benefits, Murdoch's style of journalism and particular properties, as opposed to, say, a tax that would have generally distributed advertising money to news organizations across the board, which is, by the way, a much better policy. So this was, you know, not a great, there were no good guys in this battle, right? You basically had two greedy billionaires putting the flow of news and information in Australia up for grabs. There was nobody acting in any civically minded way, not even the Australian Parliament.
We're talking with Siva Vaidyanathan, who directs the Center for Media and Citizenship at the University of Virginia. Should Facebook have to pay publishers for their news content? What precedent will the Australian government set for future regulatory frameworks in the world? Did Facebook's abrupt move to cut off news pages concern you, considering the threat of misinformation online? Join in your perspective here, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking about Facebook and Australia reaching a deal to restore news content on the platform and what the negotiations signal for regulatory efforts elsewhere in the world, like here in the U.S. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Australian government's news media bargaining code is the point of contention here. It is proposed it would require Facebook and other online platforms to negotiate a fair payment with news publishers for displaying their content. And initially, Facebook's news blackout also cut access to the Australian government's pandemic response and public health information. How do you feel about the face-off between governments and big tech? Is revenue from clicks to a site enough, or should Facebook pay for news stories? 800-642-1234. We have Siva Vaidyanathan, who is a media studies professor at the University of Virginia. He's with us for about 10 more minutes. Siva, I want to go back to something you said, that Facebook needs this news content, these news stories, more than the publishers need Facebook. Tell us more there.
Right. So this is a different story for Google, by the way. So we need to consider Google and Facebook very differently.
Okay.
Look, Facebook decides for us what we see when we scroll through the news feed. We tend to follow certain sites. We might even like certain sites. And we share our own stories of interest. But in terms of what gets thrown in front of us, it's algorithmically driven. It's Facebook making decisions for us. Now, while the remarkable amount of time that people spend on Facebook has certainly changed how we consume news, how we deal with news, it's really not how news needs to be distributed, and it wasn't always how news was distributed, and it's not even the major way news is distributed, right? Mm-hmm. People still get most of their news from television and radio. People still subscribe to newspapers, although in lower and lower numbers every year. People still register with and subscribe to online publications, including newspapers, at high rates. The ways we get newspapers is actually pretty diverse. The most important outlet for the distribution of information in terms of citizenship, in terms of what we need to be responsible citizens, is Google. Google has much more power over what we see and how we see it than Facebook, ultimately, because we often are looking for information about a subject that didn't come before us in whatever news feed we're looking through. So, look, the news world outlet is actually pretty diverse, and news disappearing from Facebook, I have to say, isn't the worst thing in the world. Like, for instance, for a few days in Australia, my friends' news feeds were filled with puppies and babies and weddings, all the reasons that we signed up for Facebook in the first place, you know? And people who wanted to understand what was going on in Parliament or understand the virus, the pandemic and all the implications, they went to news sites and they got information that was responsible. Now, the downside is, of course, that Facebook is so overwhelmed with bad information, with, you know, conspiracy theories, with outright lies, with all sorts of anti-vaccine information, with all sorts of QAnon information. I mean, really dangerous stuff that's going to get people killed. And that was going to be the case anyway. And by the way, that stuff flows better than legitimate news anyway on Facebook. Facebook's algorithms amplify the things that generate strong emotions. And that could be puppy pictures and baby pictures, but it could be QAnon or anti-vaccine or other conspiracy theories or hate speech or calls for genocide in Myanmar, which, you know, has been a major problem, right? So Facebook is really good at amplifying the stuff that makes us feel a lot, because that's what keeps us on Facebook. And that is not good for news, or that's not good for citizens who need news in a deliberate, calm way. So, you know, I had a moment where I thought, you know, this is an interesting experiment. We could see whether, Facebook in Australia is actually a better experience under these circumstances. And I don't think that we had enough time to figure that out.
So, Siva, I want to ask you this about the economics behind this. I mean, what is the cost of a forthcoming law like this if Facebook would have to comply? Like, what would these contracts, you know, cost? What is the cost of news to these platforms?
Well, there's no way to know, largely because all of these contracts would be negotiated separately, and over time there would be some sort of range, and then the arbitration board would have a sense of that range. So there's no way to know. But I would say that given the billions of dollars that Facebook and Google make every week across the world on advertising, chances are it would have been half a day's worth of revenue for any of these companies. Maybe less, you know, maybe just a few hours of revenue for these companies. You know, it wasn't at all about the money. For Zuckerberg, it was about the principle. You know, Zuckerberg is an idealist, and this is really hard to understand sometimes. Zuckerberg is an idealist about Facebook. He truly believes that the more time we spend on Facebook, the better off we will be as people, the better off we will be as societies. He truly believes that what is good for Facebook is good for the world, human beings, everything. And it's impossible to shake him from that that notion. It's all he's grown up with, right? Since he was a kid, he's believed he was improving the world, and no one's going to move him from that idea, all of this cognitive dissonance of the last 5 years notwithstanding. So here was Australia, and not the first time. As I said, other countries have made similar moves. Australia saying, basically, we are going to change the deal. We're going to change the contract. Instead of just assuming that everything published to the web can be linked to and excerpted by a big commercial presence without any payment or permission, we are going to insist that this be a business transaction.
Yeah. I want to pause here as we talk with you, Siva Vaidyanathan, a media studies expert, about Facebook's deal with Australia, giving it a way around a proposed digital media law and trying to avoid required payments to publishers for news content. You can join in with your insights, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Steve now in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I just want to, you know, a guest made a comment about Facebook and conspiracy theories, and that's true. But I do wonder what the guest's position on in our own media in this country. And I can pick on NPR, who have their own conspiracy theories that are out there. For example, systemic racism, war on women, that Trump did not condemn white supremacists, Russian collusion. I can go on and on and on. Just wondering where his concern is in our own media that spreads similar conspiracy theories.
Steve, thanks. Siva, yeah.
Sure. I can't take that question seriously. I can't imagine that a serious examination of what we've just been through in the last 4 or 5 years can yield a conclusion like that. I mean, this is not a serious question. As someone who lives in Charlottesville, Virginia, I'm actually pretty rocked by that question. I think it's really dangerous that we have Americans who actually believe that sort of thing. And yet this is a big problem, right? Because we have so much untethered craziness flying around social media, it's almost impossible to have a rational conversation with people in this country anymore.
Well, let me ask you this.
We have to address at its root.
Let me ask you this. You know, Microsoft supports a version of the Australian law here in the U.S. Is there any chance that a law like Australia would come through regulatory framework here in the U.S.?
I don't think so. I don't think there's any appetite in this country to force any sort of commercial negotiation. You know, Congress at this point is very willing to scream at Facebook and very willing to scream at Google, but not willing to consider any meaningful legislation. And by the way, that doesn't mean I approve of the Australian law. I actually think it's poorly thought out. I think there are better ways to address the misbalance and refund responsible journalism. But, you know, it's really not on the table in this country. It is on the table in Canada.
What is Canada doing that you see that might be more productive?
I mean, right now, Canada is just considering a variety of alternatives. As far as I know, there's been no specific legislation launched, but there are people in the government who are watching Australia and wondering if this is a model. Now, you know, the thing is, I'm pretty sure that in 2 or 3 weeks, we are going to see this story fade. I think we are going to say, oh, look, they basically settled on a quiet deal between Rupert Murdoch and Mark Zuckerberg, two billionaires who are going to make sure that the money flows back and forth, and it never becomes a big thing. That's Mark Zuckerberg's big interest here, that this not become attractive to the whole world. Like, he's willing to cut Australia an exception as long as it doesn't
It stays to the continent. It doesn't spread to other continents.
What he wants, and I'm pretty sure that Rupert Murdoch's going to get what he wants. I'm pretty sure it's all going to work out fine for the billionaires.
We only have a few seconds left, but what do you see in your crystal ball as the future of social media and how it's regulated?
Oh my gosh! So in this country, again, I don't have a lot of optimism that we're going to see any sort of deeply thought out and effective regulation for two reasons. One, so many of the big problems we see on Facebook are free speech problems. And that means, of course, our First Amendment limits any effective regulation. And that's probably for the best in most cases. I'm not arguing against that, but it does mean that it's a fact of life. Facebook has corrupted our public sphere. Facebook has distracted us and disrupted us and divided us and made it really hard to deliberate in a serious way about serious issues. An example being that previous caller who clearly doesn't think deeply or seriously.
But Siva, we're out of time. Thank you for joining us.
Okay, my pleasure.
Siva Vaidyanathan is a Robertson Professor of Media Studies and Director of the Center for Media and Citizenship at the University of Virginia. Ahead this hour, we learn about the pandemic's toll on musicians as we check in with Door County folk musician Katie Dahl. We'll be here and we'll hear her music. News update is next. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life, and this month marks the program's 10th anniversary on WPR. As part of the celebration, here's WPR's Cynthia Woodland reflecting on one of her favorite stories, one where she visits a Madison kitchen to hear about a special holiday treat.
When Wisconsin Life kicked off 10 years ago, I got involved because I love recording people's stories in their own words. It's like opening a window into someone else's world. I especially like highlighting voices that are seldom heard. One of my favorite stories centered around a holiday food tradition common in African-American families. In preparation for Thanksgiving, Madison's Carlotta Kalmis invited me into her kitchen to tell the story of food, family, and one of her favorite traditional desserts, that sweet, glorious, golden delight, peach cobbler.
I probably would start with maybe 3/4 cup of the peach reserve juice. And I would probably just stir that till you get all the lumps out. I've been cooking since I can remember. I'm what's called a scratch cook, where I very rarely have recipes. It's a little bit of this, a little bit of that. What makes a good peach cobbler is a combination of sugar and the right spices and the right combination of butter. And that's pretty good. So what I'm doing now is just putting some flour on this board. Of course, everything is also about the crust. You got to have a crust that's nice and flaky, that has a good taste to it, that has a little crisp to it. The best dough recipe I have, I substitute my liquid. So instead of using water, I use orange juice. This pan here was my grandmother's pan. And my grandmother also, she did her a lot of canning. So I grew up eating peach preserves, canned peaches. And I remember some nights that was our dinner. We had fried salt pork, canned peaches and homemade biscuits and syrup. And that was dinner. And we were very grateful. We didn't know we were poor, you know. Thanksgiving is a big holiday at my house. And I've had as many as 50 people at my house for Thanksgiving. Tables all over the place. Tables in the dining room, tables in the kitchen, table in the basement. People sitting at card tables or TV trays. So there's some things, traditional things that I always have. It's peach cobbler. No matter how I try not to make it, there people are, where's the peach cobbler? I tried one year and didn't have peach cobbler and said, I'm going to do apple pie instead. I end up throwing half the apple pie away. People just said, I'd rather have peach cobbler. Behind it is love. Behind it is history, legacy. I am what I am in the kitchen because of Cordelia Clark, my grandmother, and Lucille Verge Tucker, my mother. You know, they came through hard times. My mother had 11 children, so she had to know how to throw something together to make a meal to feed all of us. You know, the most important times happen around food. You know, it's an opportunity for people to come together in fellowship and talk about their day or what's going on in their life. And what better place to do it around the kitchen table or around a dining room table? So, happy Thanksgiving, everybody. So now that's a nice, perfect pie. And then I'll probably just take a little nutmeg.
That was Carlotta Calmise sharing how she makes one of her family's favorite mouth-watering holiday dishes, peach cobbler. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Cynthia Woodland.
And now, musicians struggling to keep their livelihood intact in this pandemic. It's been nearly a year since COVID essentially shut down concert tours, shut down music festivals. These are the financial mainstays of working musicians. And it's been a little over a year since we last talked with Door County folk musician Katie Dahl about her fifth album, Wildwood, and performing on stages across Wisconsin and the world. Oh boy, but what a difference a year makes. Are you a songwriter? How has your relationship to music changed? And what's inspiring you? How are you getting by? 800-642-1234 to join in. Katie Dahl, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks.
Well, songwriting doesn't always come easy. I'm wondering how songwriting has been for you during COVID.
Well, it's been at the beginning, I think there were so many feelings to process that I was sort of writing, you know, against my will. My will was to like make cookies and lay around all day. And also I have a 4-year-old, so there was a lot to do with him. But so at the beginning, I wrote a fair amount. But more recently, it has felt sort of like you think that you have more time than you have. I've talked to a lot of people across a lot of different disciplines who feel like, oh, this is an open time when we have so much just space. But really, it's just taking a lot of energy just to kind of live, I think, right now. So I haven't been writing as much lately.
You know, you studied English in college. You dreamed of being a folk musician. And I want to know, what do you love about working with language and literature and colliding it all with storytelling through music?
I love it so much. I mean, I feel so lucky. I think when I was in college, I used to say, like, if I could do anything I want, I would be a folk musician, but I know I can't do that. So, I just thought it was a crazy career path, which it is. But I so key into language, no matter what I'm doing. If I'm talking to a plumber, I've listened to what he's saying. If I'm, you know, whatever. So I language is just where my brain goes, and it feels like a real gift to get to play with that and to sort of collide it, as you say, with music.
You released a song at the outset of the pandemic. It's called I Already Knew. Can you play a little and then we can talk about it?
Sure. Yep.
The in and out is all we get to keep. Nose to throat, to lung, to heart, to blood, to rosy cheek. Days go by in minutes, the hours last a week. The in and out is all we keep. I'm learning what I already knew, that all the mighty millions are really just the fragile few. Empires shake and bodies break, and I love you. I love you, I already knew.
Oh, Katie, every word placement is just stunning. What moved you to write this song?
Well, I was, thank you. I was in Europe. I was about to start my first European tour. And the day I got to my hotel in Amsterdam, the pandemic sort of really hit in full force, and my tour mate and I had to turn around and come home. And I had the idea for this song in my hotel in Amsterdam during the crazy, frantic days when we were trying to rebook flights home. And I wrote a lot of it on the way, on the plane ride back, and then a lot of it in my quarantine period after I'd gotten back.
How did you deal with that? Just with the having to, you know, you had wanted that European tour so badly, and dealing with that disappointment of having to scratch the whole thing.
Yeah, you know, it really was disappointing. On the other hand, I was relieved to have the decision sort of made for us. You know, when we went, everything was, there was this uncertainty, like, is it wise to go or is it not? And one thing I have found sort of a relief about the pandemic is to, I'm always more worried about things than other people. And I feel like in the pandemic, like other people are also worried. So I felt like, oh, everyone is sort of having to stop their lives. You know, it felt less tragic than if some personal circumstance had stopped the tour. I just felt like, oh, the whole, I felt like we're really in this as a team. Yeah, you know, it's crazy.
It's so much worry to go around. Let's bring in a call now. Teresa is with us from Stevens Point. Hi, Teresa. What would you like to say? Hi.
Well, I can relate. I mean, my husband doesn't travel to Amsterdam to do music or things like that, but this...
Oh, sorry. Your radio is on in the background, but I understand that your spouse is a church musician, and it has also affected him and his ability to be able to play music and to make ends meet. Katie, how have you been trying to look at the workarounds to that, to be able to still make money but also follow your passion?
Yeah, it has really been, that has really been the challenge of the year. And frankly, when you asked earlier about songwriting, part of the reason I haven't been writing as much is because I've been making a whole new business plan, really. So I, this past summer, I did a lot of curbside song drop-offs. I retrofitted an old minivan of ours, painted it turquoise and called it the Songmobile. And I drove around and made it kind of like a rolling venue with speakers and everything, and drove around and sang songs for people, you know, outside their front doors. And I started a page called a Patreon page, where I sort of post exclusive content and people support me monthly. People have been so generous, by the way. And I think people are so wise to think about the crazy business plan that is being an independent musician, and have been really generous in supporting me via that Patreon page and other donations. And I also started a live stream series called Katie Doll Has Friends, where I ask friends of mine in different disciplines to come on, who I would never, you know, been able to get in one place, of course, physically. It's kind of a silver lining. So I've had like my friend, the author Parker Palmer, who's from Madison, my friend Peter Mulvey, who's a songwriter, people from all sorts of, all around the world and in all sorts of disciplines. So that's another way that I've been sort of trying to make ends meet.
We're talking with Door County musician Katie Doll about making music in the pandemic. Are you a fan of folk, this genre, or a fan of Katie's music? What do you love about it? How are you providing support to a musician or band whose work you care a lot about? Be part of this 800-642-1234. Back in a minute, more conversation with Katie Doll here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with folk musician Katie Doll. The music and entertainment industry has taken a huge hit, and we're learning how Katie Doll has adapted to the demands of the pandemic. Are you a singer-songwriter? How are you finding new inspiration in these times? Is songwriting harder or easier? What does making music mean to you? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Katie Dahl is with us for about 10 more minutes. You know, what speaks to me in your music is that it's so grounded in a sense of place, and that this placemaking happens in your songs. And, you know, Wildwood, your album Wildwood, is really a tribute to Door County. How has that album taken on new meaning for you in the pandemic?
Well, you know, that album in a lot of ways is sort of a reflection on my ancestry, which to me is really tied up in this place. I think about my grandma who was born here and her parents and who were also born here. And I've been thinking a lot about hard times that they experienced. Of course, there was the 1918 pandemic, a million hard things, you know, that you can think back on. And I've been,
because
I've
your
been really
ancestors
trying to think,
have been in Door County since the mid 1800s.
That's right. Exactly. And so I've been thinking, I've been thinking this land, this, you know, this place, this literal soil has seen these hard things before. It's a lot older than I am. And this is not new. Another line in that I already knew song that I didn't play is there's nothing's ever new beneath the cold winter sun. And I've been thinking like, this is not new. And I've been really trying to sort of draw on the wisdom of the place in order to remind myself of that.
One of the songs on Wildwood is Worry My Friend. Can you play a little and then we'll talk about it?
Yeah.
I took a walk in the redwood trees out in California. Thought the trees might speak to me that warm and windless summer day, saying we've been here 500 years by the wild Pacific Sea. But I took one look at those big old trees and I worried they would fall on me. Worry, my friend. Worry, my shepherd and shield. I've borrowed more trouble than I'll ever repay. Frost on the summer field.
It just seems like, you know, fear and anxiety are just all around us in COVID. But then there's nature. What does nature do for you?
Well, when I make myself get out into it, it does amazing things. It's so tempting to just stay inside, right?
Yeah.
I started running actually during this pandemic, which is very atypical of me. And I think it was like part of the joy of it was being outside, you know, every day. Now I've been doing that inside. We got a treadmill, but I, you know, when I was doing it outside, it is such a gift to like be in the same place every day. I usually travel a lot more, you know, and to be in the same place every day and sort of watch things change really gradually from one day to the next. If I was go running the same place in Peninsula State Park, it's like, wow, you know, this is a miracle. I'm not driving in a car, you know, across the country. I'm watching this thing change very slowly, which is great.
And I imagine, too, that you're absorbing everything around you because you never know when it may come out in your music.
That's right. That's the goal, right, is to really try to be observant and let it soak in.
Yeah. And certainly when you're not traveling, you don't have those otherworldly opportunities to soak in what's around you and find other inspiration.
Right. Exactly. I've been reading a lot and watching a lot of awesome TV, and that's, you know, the inspiration comes from everywhere, from my kid, from my husband. So for sure, there's a lot of inspiration to be had.
We're talking with Door County folk musician Katie Dahl about her music in the pandemic. You can join in. Are you a musician? What have you been writing about lately? 800-642-1234. You have a new song. It's called Silhouette. Can you play a little? Let's listen.
Yeah.
How do you know that you love who you love? Do you wait for a flood? Do you send out a dove? When I get to wondering how deep or how high, I close my eyes, think about the day you'll die. all of the day you'll die. I saw death in New Orleans, smoking a serpent pipe, sipping scotch bonnet tea. He was looking at you, you were looking at me. He was hanging a bloom on the magnolia tree. Me and you, that magnolia tree. Hey, yeah, yeah.
I used to have a magnolia in my front yard. It smelled, oh, it smelled glorious in Louisiana. But the word death comes up in this song. What is going on?
Well, that song is really about Pont. My husband, I'm relieved to say, is great and wonderful. But this pandemic always makes you, or pandemic has really made me think about who I could lose and how do I know that I value them without thinking about what it would be like to lose them? I don't know how people, some people don't seem to think about, you know, worry about their loved ones dying all the time. But for me, that like worrying about my loved ones and imagining them not there is a way of sort of finding the hugeness of my love for them, you know, to imagine what it would be like, how big would that hole be if you weren't there, is a way of thinking, like, wow, that's an enormous amount of love that I feel. So that's really what that song is sort of a meditation on.
Let's bring in Colin in La Crosse. Hi, Colin.
Hi, good morning. I really love this topic. Answer what it's like to be a songwriter during a pandemic too. I found it's kind of a time to innovate and kind of reform a little. And I'm still a budding songwriter and trying to learn where my niche is, but it's been great to kind of be forced to reach out with friends at a distance and start collaborating and writing music through the magic of the internet. I found that really awesome right now. So thank you.
Colin, thank you for that. Katie, do you have any inspiring words for Colin, who is starting out in songwriting?
I wish that I did. I mean, I do think that what I think as a songwriter is that I have a friend who's a prose writer, and she said, you know, the work doesn't get easier, but it does get better. And I feel that way. I think it's a lot of work, songwriting. I think people sort of envision, oh, I have this inspiration and then it just all comes out. But actually for me, a song is probably 20 or 30 or 50 hours of sitting and sort of agonizing. And I really, it's hard work. And it still is hard for me. It's not easier, but it is, I do see that I've learned my craft, you know, more and more as I've now been writing for 17 years, I think. And
We only have a couple seconds left. I'm trying to imagine you in this retrofitted minivan going around playing your music. How has that been received?
How has it been received?
Yeah.
Did you say?
Yeah.
Oh, it's been, I think people are like, baffled, you know, no one, and thrilled, you know, like no one knows what's going on in the world. And it's like there's this thing driving around Door County that says Songmobile Katie Dahl. It's very bright blue, robin's egg blue, and so it's fun.
Oh, Katie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Katie Dahl is a folk musician based in Door County, and her latest album is Wildwood. If you're a Wisconsin musician open to sharing your new music on The Morning Show, connect with us at WPR.org/mornings. That's WPR.org/mornings. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.